fed up with politics, disenchanted, disengaged, distrustful of the political business as usual? Well, if you are, you're probably not alone. Not in this country and not in the world. If anything, we've been lagging a little in Australia. We're sort of rusted on to the, hard-to-budge faith in the traditional two-party machines of power. Overseas ballot boxes are full of votes for new political movements, all of them pretty much claiming a fresh take on politics as usual. Think UKIP in Britain, comedian Beppe Grillo and his five-star movement in Italy, the Tea Party even in the United States. In Australia, well, is minority ditch-the-witch, ICAC, wink-gate politics beginning to leave a bad taste in the national mouth? Maybe it is. How else do you explain the sudden magnetic but rather vague charm of the Palmer Uniting Party? We seem to be entering the age of anti-politics. Something to talk about at any rate. Joining me now is former Liberal leader John Hewson, Dr. Tad Tietzer, who's a Sydney psychiatrist. He writes for the blog The Left Flank, and Damon Alexander, who's a research fellow at the School of Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. Welcome to you all.
Hi,
morning. Hi, John.
Tad, can I go to you first? This idea of anti-politics, instinctively, it feels like a notion whose time has come.
Yeah, I think so, and I think it's people, I think, don't really understand where it's come from or why it's come. I think people often think it's just about the failure of our existing political class to make a good case for things. And, you know, the last week we've got plenty of evidence of the existing political class not making a very good case for anything in Australia.
It's been a bad time for politics, you'd have to say.
Yes. But I think it goes deeper than just that. I think there's been a long-term structural breakdown of the way that politics operated in the 20th century, where we had mass parties, or at least parties like the Labour Party, that were tied to mass organisations like the unions. And the political system had a certain stability through depression, through war and so on. And that's really eroded and broken down. You can look at statistics in most countries where there's just been a desertion of the mass of people from these kinds of institutional structures, from participation and so on, and a growing feeling amongst people, which might be a quite accurate feeling, that those people in politics, they don't really have anything to do with our interests, certainly not with the general interest of society.
Is that a breakdown, as you phrase it, or are we in the process of a reorganisation of our politics? I mean, the two parties that we have in this country that we invest so much faith in, they came from a time when so much was so different, you know, when travel was different, when communication was different, when the social structures were different. It's natural enough that we should, over time, move away from that.
I think the big problem is that for the parties to, or some new configuration to be stable, would require rebuilding actual social connections to people, not just the ability of a politician to speak through the media to the people, but have no real connection with them. There were real mediated connections between the politicians and the organisation and the activists on the ground and so on in workplaces and communities. And this was true for both the left and the right of politics, I think, even though it played out in different ways. To rebuild those structures would mean that something would have to come from civil society, I think, that wanted to rebuild that. And so far, we haven't seen that. Instead, we see politicians running around looking for a base and trying to cohere a base from these fragments they can't seem to be able to corral for very long.
John Hewson, does that ring true to you? And if so, how did that disconnection take place? What was the process of that disconnection, do you think?
There have been a lot of factors, I would say. I mean, the fact that politics really has just become a game. It's played out in the media on a daily basis. And, you know, a lot of the actors in that are people who have only ever been part of the political system. They're apparatchiks, as we call them, but they've never had a real job in their life. They didn't come in at the end of a career to make a contribution to society. It's a game that they have to win. They have to win the game on the day. The next day we move to another location, another issue, and over time, I mean, it's debased itself. Politics is no longer a respected profession. It's looked down on by just about everyone. A lot of people now see it as irrelevant to their daily lives. And I think that's part and parcel of the process that Tad's just been describing, really. When you get ministers, well, people becoming ministers who've had no experience in managing anything, particularly a large government department, or delivering a program like Pink Bats, or even Operation, what is it, Secure Borders, or whatever. I mean, you see people who are struggling in these roles, and that further feeds the impression, I think, in the community that these people are not interested in our lives, they're not interested in solving problems, they're not interested in detailed policy. We've had the farce in the last week where we're told that there was a dot point announced at the last election, which was, I'll fix the budget, and forget all the other things I might have said behind that. I'm fixing the budget, I haven't broken any promises. I think everybody just in an enormous yawn. They can't believe that you could just continue to, you know, misrepresent your own behaviour, let alone the circumstance, and without solving the problem. A lot of pain inflicted on particular groups without any particular gain in relation to the budget. And the big problems in the out years of the budget, the big expenditure commitments that both sides have made, are still there. And the inequity of the process, to argue that, well, everyone's sharing the burden, when obviously they're not, because people under, you know, at the bottom end of the income scale are losing 12 to 15% of their disposable income, and people at the top are losing less than 1%. The inequity just screams at you, yet they can't sort of acknowledge it.
And yet, those issues, I mean, this isn't the first time something like that has happened around a budget. I guess the difference, and Damon, to bring you in here, the difference now is that we see through it. I think for various reasons that we see through the process and make decisions about it. And Damon, one of the responses to that has been the rise of the politician who takes that as an opportunity, the sort of the anti-politics politician.
Yeah, that's not necessarily anything new either, but I think the opportunities have become much, much more frequent and much larger when they come. The level in disenchantment...
Giving you plenty to work with here.
I look back to the rise of Hansenism, which I've done quite a bit of work on, and I see very similar things to what I see now with the rise of parties like Palmer, although thankfully with Palmer United we haven't had the sort of race angle that came with it. But the level of disenchantment, when you have the years that we've had under Gillard and Rudd and the internal party politicking that seemed to become much more important than actual policy, followed by, or at that same time, you've got an opposition that keeps hammering away that the importance of trust and the importance of telling the truth, and then the first thing they do when they come to their first budget is to throw all that out the window. It can't be put any more in your face as a voter than that.
And part of that political tactic, and we saw that during the Rudd-Gillard years, part of the political tactic is to actually undermine confidence in the process from the point of view of opposition, which feeds on this impression of the whole setup being in decay.
Yeah, but part of it also, I take it back a little bit, probably on a little bit of a different tangent. I go back to the voter. Like, you could go back to John and blame John for a lot of this. John was the last politician that had the temerity to go to an election with an actual honest program and paid for it.
I think the longest political suicide note in history, I'm told.
But I think as voters, it's important that we take more notice of when this happens, and that we actually follow through with our selection when it comes to the ballot box and actually hold these people accountable.
And we're better equipped these days, Tad, to make those decisions and to make our view known out of the cycle. We can do much more in terms of political voice than simply vote.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, at the very simple level, people like myself, blogging, social media and so on. At a greater level, though, I think the crisis of the political structures means that there is actually space for anti-political social movements to be heard. I don't think we've really seen it in Australia. I'm one of the few people on the left who's not as impressed with the organisers of the March and Marches as some seem to be, because I think they're still essentially political movements, partisan against, this time against the government rather than necessarily for those two parties that were just in power beforehand. But I think in Spain especially, we've seen a genuinely anti-political and radical social movement saying, I mean, its key slogan was, they don't represent us, or none of them represent us. A real rejection of both sides of politics and saying, ordinary people need to take this into their own hands.
And what's the character of movements like that, and where do they lead? What's the alternative position, I guess?
Yeah, I think there's been two things that have happened in Spain. One is that the radicalisation that started in those square protests has moved over into other aspects of society. So there's been a radicalisation in workplaces and in communities and so on. There have been very successful anti-eviction campaigns because in the crisis there were a lot of foreclosures. But the other side of it is they are now, those movement activists realise they have to do something. Even if they don't like politics, they've got to intervene into it in order to disrupt it on behalf of the movement. And there's a new electoral formation that's rapidly gaining influence in Spain in the lead up to the Euro elections called Podemos, or We Can. So I think they've looked at different ways to try to deal with this, because obviously you can't make politics go away, even if it's in a total mess, if you're a radical social movement activist. But I think there lies the kind of the potential for actually really changing how things are done. Perhaps even in a way where politics itself becomes a thing of the past and we organise things differently.
There's clearly all sorts of reasons why that becomes more of a potential in modern culture than it has been. But, Damon, the other part of that is in that sort of transitional phase where people enter politics with that idea of changing politics. Traditionally, they're consumed by it nonetheless.
Yeah. I'm probably not quite as cynical, and I'm not convinced that we're shifting onto or that we need to necessarily shift onto a fundamentally different structure. The politicians I talk to now still are very genuinely committed to doing what's in the best interest of their voters in most cases. You get the rogue, self-interested person that goes into it for nothing more than their own interest, but they're fairly rare, I would argue. I think the big problem we have now is this juncture between the people at grassroots level not being able to have any sort of impact in shaping the way parties behave in government. And I think both sides of politics are probably moving towards doing things about that. And you can see, for example, some of the reforms in Canada where party membership or party decision-making structures are being opened up to grassroots members or even non-members in some situations. I think that's more likely to be a way forward. I don't think it's politics that's the problem. It's the practice of party politics that's the main issue. And I think there needs to be a distinction made between that.
We're wondering whether we're entering an age of anti-politics here on Sunday Extra. And your guests are Damon Alexander, who's from the University of Melbourne, Tad Tietzer, who's a blogger and psychiatrist, usefully, and former Liberal leader John Hewson. John, within a traditional political party, what's the resistance to that sort of contact with the community? Are there institutional things within big party processes which inevitably remove the party from contact with its base?
I guess there's a bit of a sentiment that, politics would be a lot of fun if you didn't have voters, that you could just get on and play the game.
We could be running a perfectly good hotel if it wasn't for you guests.
That's right, university fund without students, yeah, all those sort of lines. But I don't know why it is that once they seem to get there, they seem to develop a life of their own within that context and to lose touch with the people that put them there and forget why they're there. Now, I agree with Damon that most people would say and most act as if they are genuinely interested in making a contribution and making a difference and so on when they go into politics. I naively came into politics back in the Phil Lynch days as his advisor in the naive belief that good policy was good politics with a relatively short lag. Now we have a very long lag, but I do think that people are looking for the balance of power in the Senate or a political force that says, look, these are the problems, this is what has to be done to solve them, and we are going to do that. You can hold us accountable for that. It would be a completely refreshing approach to just what we've had so far. The policy has not been elevated, it's just been driven down to the point of the last campaign, each side had a range of dot points which they were committed to and added bits and pieces around that, and I do think that we're going to in the end get back to substantive policy that will determine the outcome. And right now the electorate, for example, take New South Wales, the concern about ICAC and political influence lobbying, and okay, one tenet of a political force would be let's clean that up seriously. And then there's a budgetary problem, let's do that in an equitable way. there's infrastructure, let's finance it properly, not just pretend that we're doing all these new projects. You could actually deliver some substantive policy that people, I think, would vote for. And I'm surprised that that doesn't come out of this process. In the end, you get a budget that... The thing that surprised me most about, I guess, Joe Hockey and Tony Abbott in the last few days is that they obviously are quite surprised by the reaction they got.
Yes.
I think they actually did believe that they'd, you know, brought down the budget of the century, and it actually will be remembered as probably one of the worst because it was so ill-conceived, so many incoherent messages, so many partial attempts to solve problems with massive inequity overriding the lot, a lot of pain for very little gain. What do they do now? I mean, if the revenue continues to be weaker than predicted, which is, I think, a pretty high probability, then the deficit will start to blow out and they can't go back and try and fix it again because, I feel like a bit like Philip Lynch felt back in the middle 70s. He was pilloried for being the razor gang and going too hard on the profligate Whitlam years, only to have the, for the Fraser government to spend the rest of the next 7 years of their term trying to find ways in which to cut expenditure or raise tax to bring the deficit under control. So I think they're there again now, unfortunately.
Could I suggest a reason why the solution may not come so easily? And I think it goes back to the era of Hawke, Keating and Hewson, actually. What the Labor Party and the trade unions did in the 80s was they hollowed out their own social base because they delivered a political settlement that helped revive Australian business. A great deal of that was at the expense of wages of ordinary wage workers. It was a sacrifice they had the authority to deliver because the union structures were powerful, they were well tied into the politicians and so on. By the time John comes with his reform program to extend that process, really a logical extension of what's happened in the 80s, there's no longer a social base to drive through that kind of agenda. There's actually, those connections are gone, those real abilities to win those arguments at the micro level are not there because the political class is already much more separated from the rest of the population. And that's what makes me think that any project that does appeal to exactly the things that John talks about, and I think there is great scope for temporary revival, they're going to find it hard to actually build a real social base to carry that on election after election.
But into that vacuum, Tad, and we're seeing this at the moment in Europe, we have parties which frame themselves, which appeal, you know, the basis of their appeal is into that space of anti-politics, into that space of reconnection, and yet it's, in many instances, it's neo-nationalism masquerading as that sort of new politics. I mean, there's great potential to take that as a starting point to your appeal and then distorting that into, you know, very traditional political forms as well.
See, I think that distortion point is very important. Yep. I mean, they might start with the best of intentions. I remember Don Chipp, for example, annoyed by the fact he'd been overlooked for a ministry, sets up his own party to keep the bastards honest, the Democrats. And that worked very well for a while until the question came, how do we keep those bastards honest? It lost its way. Yeah. And that does happen. That distortion happens because they lose sight of the original reason they're there. I think if the Democrats had continued to play that role objectively, they'd still be a powerful political force in this
country. And Damon, we were about to see that in action again with our new Senate, with the power that's been vested in Mr. Palmer.
Yes.
How he deals with that is going to be instructive.
It's going to be a very interesting time to look at the Senate, I think. And with most minor parties, you can at least get a bit of a read on them from the platform that they put forward. I've found Palmer incredibly difficult to read. And I'm not sure if that's because there's nothing there or if it's because he's incredibly pragmatic or if he's going to be an open mind.
But he's someone who takes this moment that we've been talking about, the lack of faith, the disengagement, and that is his reason for being. There is no policy surrounding it. It's purely, actually, I'm an alternative to what those guys are doing, is
it's
his pitch.
Almost an anti-party approach to performing the traditional role, I suppose, or the original role of a democratic parliamentarian listening and weighing up the options and making a rational judgment based on the actual issue itself rather than being locked into a party platform. But whether that comes through in actual policy decisions and votes in Parliament will be very interesting to watch. But
there's another thing in this too, John Hewson, of the the line that conservative politics has taken for a while now of the diminishment of government, of actually, you know, as part of the platform and trying to talk down the significance of the role of the state, that in a funny sort of way argues against confidence in politics as well.
Yes, and they then don't practice it. They talk about how they might expand government. And
hang on, you know, that's me.
This process of, we're talking about the major parties losing their way, but look, the minor parties, the Greens, for example, you would have thought, given that their principal policy focus is on redistribution, that when you see a proposal to increase the tax rate on the top income classes, that they'd support it. And no, they're going to oppose it this time. And the negativity of the process has taken over, and it's now distorting their so-called policy positions. And I guess Palmer is interesting because he's different, but I suspect he's just for Clive. And how do we understand where he's going to go? Or just understand what he thinks is, you know, best to demonstrate his influence in the political process and take it from there. But it won't necessarily result in better government. A minority party with power that doesn't actually, you know, add value to the process, but perhaps compounds
the
weakness
of
the process, I think, is a bit of an issue.
Ted, I mean, just to conclude this, I mean, it's interesting that we start from a proposition which, as you put it originally when we began this chat, is fairly far in advance of the two-party structures we have now, of social organisations actually working in counterpoint to traditional politics. Is that the way of our future?
I'd like to think it is, but that's my political position, I guess. The other possibility, I think, which is very real and a bit more scary, is that all sections of politics decide this has all become a bit hard, and they hand over to unelected technocrats like we saw in Greece and Italy in recent times. And the technocrats, at least whilst they weren't running for parliament, were actually much more popular than the governments that preceded them and followed them. I don't think we're at that stage where the populace has a real distrust of the state. They have a distrust of the political class so far, but it could easily fall over into other institutions, and that could mean that demagogues could come along with extremely radical authoritarian solutions, or people could end up deciding they do need to reorganise society. And I suppose if the economic winds eventually hit Australia as badly as they've hit elsewhere, we might see all those kinds of processes play out.
Well, there you are. You've either been warned or challenged, depending on your point of view. thanks to guests this morning. It's a fascinating discussion, and I think it's only just beginning in this country.
Thanks very much.
Former Liberal leader John Hewson, Ted Teeter, a Sydney psychiatrist whose blog you can check out, The Left Flank, and Damon Alexander, research fellow at the School of Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne.
Thanks,
this is Sunday Extra on RN.